Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous.
This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering for some. Listener discretion is advised.
All right. So at the time that everyone's listening to this, it's the day after Easter. Hope everyone had a great Easter. Hyper Kids, egg dyeing.
That's chocolate.
Yep. All the freaking meth that comes with it. Because for us, Easter hasn't happened yet. So hopefully we have a good Easter and everybody else has already had a good one. So this is part two of Veronica, Gideon, and the Easter Sunday Murders. So for anyone that has not listened to part one, you'll definitely want to go back and listen to that one first. There's a lot of information in there that's not going to be in part two that you need to have. So as a recap, we become familiar with the family dynamic of the Gideons, which is strange to say the very least. Unfortunately, in part one, we found out that two members of the Gideon family, along with a boarder in the apartment, were murdered. That was Veronica, Mary, and Frank. The police were stumped on who could have done it. There was no evidence, no forced entry, and every suspect or person of interest was clear. These included Joe Gideon, who they beat mercilessly, Ronnie's friend Stephen Butters, an old boarder George Gray, and Ronnie's ex-husband Bobby Flowers. Taking a closer look at Ronnie's diary, there was a man that she seemed to have some concerns about and possibly feared, who she only called B. After reading more, they identified the man that was most likely B, a man named Bob Irwin, who had an obsession with Ronnie's older sister, Ethel, and had previously been a boarder of the Gideon's old home. That's where we left off in part one. So, it's not really clear to me why no one had mentioned this Bob Irwin guy when the diary was first discovered, or why they didn't even ask Ethel in the very beginning. But once they learned of him and then spoke to those that knew him, they learned that he was a pretty good suspect. Born in 1906 in Pasadena, California, Bob's life had been very difficult from the beginning. His father, Benjamin Irwin, was the founder of Fire Baptist Holiness Church. Spoiler alert, it's not a real church. This is a fanatical Christian cult that operated out of Northern California.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Not a church at all. So eventually, his dad abandoned the family. His father left Bob and his two brothers in the sole care of their mother. And this happened when Bob was still very young. Their mom was just as fanatical as their father was. Even more so, actually. She put religion above everything else in her life, including her children. Bob's story is sad from the very beginning. He grew up in this cult life, his dad abandoned them, and his mom didn't care about anything other than the cult. So left to their own devices, those three boys ran wild. Bob was the middle child with, these are some weird names, okay? Vidalin. I'm not sure. I think that's how you say it, but I could be wrong. He's the older brother. And then Pimber was the younger brother. The three boys quickly became full of criminal activity. Like, all they did. The older and younger brothers spent nearly their entire lives in and out of reform schools, jails, and prison. Bob had his run-ins with the law as well, but he spent a few years at a reform school, and unlike his brothers, he had a natural talent for sculpting and other art forms. So, with this, kind of earned him some sympathy with the adults. Bob showed real talent as an artist, but unfortunately, he had also began to show signs of a very serious mental illness and delusional thinking. In his late teens and early 20s, his talent had earned him some apprenticeships with some notable artists at the time. But due to his paranoia and his explosive anger, these opportunities always fell apart not long after they started. Now, in 1932, he was sent to the Burke Foundation, which was a voluntary psychiatric facility located in White Plains, New York. After 9 months at this facility, he left claiming that he, quote, left to get away from a couple of female employees who began to make life miserable for him after he rebuffed their sexual demands.
Hmm.
Later, though, a social worker would come forward to clarify why Bob had actually left. She said it was because he had gotten into, quote, so many violent quarrels with other patients that he feared his behavior would lead to serious consequences. So he's just making shit up. So after he left the facility, Bob had moved into Mary Gideon's boarding house on East 53rd Street in October of 1932. So this is 5 years before the murders happened. This was coincidentally right around the same time that Ronnie had begun to write in her diary that investigators would find in 1937. It was here that he met and very quickly became enamored with Ethel Gideon. In more ways than one, Ethel reminded Bob of his ex-girlfriend Alice Ryan, who he was still very much obsessed with.
Yeah.
More red flags here, people.
Right.
So, once Bob became settled into the boarding house, Bob had tried to resume his art, but he found his thoughts of Alice and his preoccupation with sex dominated his mind day in and day out, which prevented him from being productive in his work. After a week of torment and no productivity, Bob decided he was going to try to rid himself of his sexual preoccupations once and for all. I want to warn everybody, okay? I'm going to mention some self-harm here, and it's a little graphic. So, be prepared for that. I'll give everybody like 30 seconds here if you want to skip forward. You can't do that though, Manny.
No, I can't. Yeah.
According to Bob, on Wednesday, October 27th, he went to the bathroom of the boarding house and put a rubber band around his penis and then went for a walk around town to numb the area.
What? Okay.
Once back at the boarding house, he went back into the bathroom and attempted to remove his male appendage with a Gillette razor.
Oh, my God. Ow.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
He said he got about halfway there, but it was obviously incredibly painful, so he wasn't able to finish.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
The hell?
He managed to get himself from the home to Bellevue Hospital. The rubber band had actually acted as a tourniquet, which kept him from bleeding out. And that was the only reason that he was able to make it to the hospital. Once there, he checked in under the name James Adamson and calmly asked the intern to finish the job for him.
I got none.
The intern obviously did not do that.
Right.
Instead, the intern simply bandaged him up and told him to come back during the day when the surgeon would be there to see him. Like, no, I'm not doing that. Come back and see the doc. Bob returned several hours later, still insisting on having his male appendage removed completely. Instead, the surgeon applied some antiseptic and sutured the serious wound and then admitted Bob to the psychiatric ward where he would stay for nearly 5 months. After this thing here, he was then transferred to Rockland State Hospital in upstate New York. During his time at Rockland, Bob proved to be an unruly patient. He made several attempts to escape the facility, including one where he made it all the way to downtown Manhattan to the apartment of his previous Bellevue psychiatrist. Thankfully, he was apprehended and returned to Rockland before anything could happen. Here at Rockland, he received his first official diagnosis of hebephrenia, which at the time was a subtype of schizophrenia, which the psychiatrist that diagnosed him described his condition as being characterized by, quote, foolish mannerisms, senseless laughter, delusions, and regressive behavior. So this is not a diagnosis given anymore. It's just schizophrenia now. It's not even listed in the statistical manual of mental disorders anymore. Okay, so after a few years of bouncing around from one boarding house to another, Bob reappeared at Mary's door in the early summer of 1934. This was a few months after Ethel had gotten married to her first husband, which was later annulled. Because remember, just like her sister, Ronnie had a teen marriage and it didn't work out. So now back in the presence of Ethel, Bob felt inspired again because Ethel was like a type of muse for Bob, I guess. He once again began to sculpt. And from the moment he returned to the house, he was devoted to Ethel. Now, Ethel liked the attention and the adoration that Bob gave her, but she never actually committed herself to him. She never saw him as a suitable partner. It was just kind of a fun, flirty thing for her. She found him attractive, like many women did, but he wasn't someone she could imagine herself with. It was just, you know, fun, harmless flirtation. So by the time Ethel had actually begun to date Joe Kuttner, who in the end she married, he was obviously much more stable than Bob was. And he was someone she could actually have a future with. Despite her wish to marry Joe, she was still indulging in this flirtation relationship with Bob and eventually allowing him to sculpt her. So, while living here at the Gideon's home for a second time, Bob once again begins to have delusional thinking, and he starts to believe in what he called visualizations. He believed his visualizations was a power that he had, which he had got by manifesting things simply by mental power and focus.
Oh, yay. Hallucinations?
Like, he's like, if I want it, it'll happen. All I have to do is manifest it. Yeah. He believed that through this process, he could obtain everything he wanted for himself. And he became extremely frustrated when things he wanted didn't appear to be going his way.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Like, you can't just manifest shit to happen, my guy. It's not how the world works.
No.
So Bob was desperate to be with Ethel, but no matter what he did or tried to prove himself in order to get her to love him, she always resisted him. And that's because Ethel loved Joe. After several months of watching this, Mary took Bob aside and gently expressed her concerns. She told him that although she was very fond of him, for the sake of her daughter's future, she was, quote, anxious that Ethel have nothing to do with Bob. Which, she told him this a lot more gentler than I just said it.
Right.
Because she did like Bob. But she wanted better for her daughter than what he could give her. Mary said that she wanted Ethel to marry a wealthy man so she didn't have to struggle like she herself had in her marriage. So, you know, she basically told him, look, you know, I like you. You're a nice guy. But you can't give Ethel what Ethel deserves. And you just need to move on with your life.
Right.
But Bob was not deterred by Mary's words at all. He continued to pursue a romantic relationship with Ethel. And a few months later, while Ethel and Bob were out on a walk, he insisted that the two get married. And now, having grown tired of Bob's relentless advances and his bizarre talk of visualization, along with his other weird and strange shit, Ethel explained to him that she wanted them to remain friends, but she had already accepted Joe's proposal and they would be getting married in a couple of months. Bob told reporters later that he went crazy after this. In the weeks that followed this conversation, he spiraled into a depression and really thought about committing suicide as he once again went from one boarding home to another. Then, in October, Bob was dealt another serious blow. After putting up with Bob's attitude and sullenness for months, his boss let him go from the production factory he was working at. In response, Bob grabbed a nearby meat cleaver and threatened to, quote, split his boss's head right down the middle.
Oh, shit.
He's a little
aggressive.
Yeah, just a little bit. So now out of work and desperate, Bob returns to Rockland Hospital where he voluntarily commits himself for treatment. I feel like that was a good call, my guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So based on this information, they learn about Bob. Detectives are convinced that he's the suspect without a doubt. Yeah, I feel like you're going in the right way now.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a problem. They have no idea where Bob is. A police spokesperson told reporters on April 5th that they had been looking for him since the murders and that they believed he was the man who did it. In response to a citywide alert placed out Bob's old landlord contacted the police because the room he had been renting out to Bob was actually located right across from the precinct.
Wow. Yeah.
By the time police arrived at this boarding house, though, he was done. He was gone. He had packed his things and fled.
Yeah.
And the landlord was like, I don't know where he went. He was here. She did remember, though, that Bob had left with two suitcases, one of them having a distinct-looking strap wrapped around it and had a large buckle to keep the suitcase closed. The news of the manhunt for Bob Irwin came as a shock to the few people that actually knew him very well. And among these was Ethel Gideon. On April 6th, she told reporters, quote, I cannot believe Irwin is the man who killed my mother and sister.
Yeah.
So while she sat down with investigators and told them everything she knew about him, more than 18,000 police officers were on the move all across the city in search of Bob. From Rockland Hospital, investigators learned that Bob had been discharged the previous October. And since then, he had just kind of been hopping around from different boarding houses across the city. While there at Rockland, for his most recent stay, his religious delusions had gotten worse. And they told investigators that he had actually began to study religion, completely putting everything else aside, including his sculpting and art. On a hunch, investigators went to Grand Station and asked baggage check if anyone had checked in any luggage that resembled what the landlady at the boarding house had described. And to their luck, someone matching Bob's description had checked in that luggage, but they had not returned to check it out. So, now with the suitcase in hand, investigators search it, and inside they find the green clock that was missing from Ronnie's room.
Oh, shit.
This piece of evidence only cemented their belief that Bob was their killer even further, and the hunt for Bob continued. It was actually the largest manhunt since the search for the Lindbergh baby only 5 years earlier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which we just covered that case. It would be last week. No, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So it was even bigger than that. So, however, despite their best efforts, it wasn't the NYPD who had found Bob. It was a tip from a reader of True Detective magazine that found and got Bob Irwin caught.
Yeah.
Like, these two True Detective magazines are like, they ain't playing. Yeah. So just as they were in the last episode, the editors of True Detective were committed to finding Ronnie's killer. They had offered a $1,000 reward for information that led to the arrest of the killer. Today, that reward would be around $22,000. Yeah. In late June of 1937, an employee of the Statler Hotel in Cleveland, Ohio, was flipping through her copy of The Detective while on her break, and she noticed a police photo of Bob. She thought this guy looked an awful lot like their new barback, Bob Murray. So amused by how much he looked like this photo, she showed it to him. And from the look on his face, she knew that this was way more than a coincidence. Bob fled the hotel that day. And by the time detectives got there, he was long gone.
Yeah.
So now, in summer of 1937, Bob's photo is plastered everywhere, across billboards, magazines, newspapers, all over the country. And it's only a matter of time before investigators catch up to him. So wanting to get in front of the story, this is just where it gets crazy. Like, this is where it gets nuts. So wanting to get in front of the story, Bob called the Chicago Tribune with an offer he knew they couldn't resist. He told them he was a friend of Robert Bob Irwin, and he wanted to give himself up. After getting through to the right person, he offered them a complete confession in exchange for $5,000 cash, a white linen suit, and a Panama hat.
What?
Yeah. So, of course, the Tribune jumped at this chance, and they agreed to meet with him at the office of the managing editor, John Dionhart. Here, Bob would sit down and tell his story on what happened. So Bob calls, you know, ring, ring. Hi, I'm Bob Irwin's friend. I can get him there because he wants to confess, you know, but it was actually Bob. So he goes in to sit down, right? He goes, sits down. And then this time it was pretty normal for papers to pay criminals in exchange for their exclusive rights to their stories or any kind of information that they felt valuable. It's kind of like today there are laws in place. Criminals can't be monetized for their crime, but the victims or the victims' families can sell their rights.
Right.
The story be, so it's like that, but back then they could pay criminals for their stories, which is just crazy to me. So, but this would be the first time that a newspaper would knowingly and deliberately shield a murderer from law in order to get a story. Yeah, it's the first time that they ever protected someone in order to get a story.
That's
so
wild.
Once this offer was on the table, they were like, you know, hell yeah, because they would do anything to get those exclusive rights and be the first one to put the story out. So, on the evening of June 26, 1937, Bob Irwin sat down with reporters and photographers from the Tribune wearing a suit at the Morrison Hotel, and he told his story. He told them that on the night, he told himself, quote, I'm going up there and killing Ethel. I never intended to get anybody but her. I thought that after killing Ethel, then they would kill me in the chair, but I didn't care. He continued on saying that he was in fact in love with Ethel and had been for a while. He said that when she rejected him, he had become so obsessed that he wasn't able to focus on anything but her. And several hospitalizations, he described that the only way to regain his focus was to rid himself of Ethel. And that was why he had decided to kill her. Not wanting to destroy her beauty, he said he decided to stab her in the back of the neck with an ice pick from his apartment. Not sure I understand the
crazy
there.
Yeah.
This motherfucker is clearly off his fucking rocker.
Most definitely.
Okay, so this is how the murders happened, according to Bob. Blech. On the night of March 28th, he went to the apartment on East 50th Street and rang the bell. Having always liked Bob, Mary led him into the apartment, which she'd been preparing for Easter dinner, which was the next day. He said that outside of Mary not wanting him to have anything to do with Ethel, she had always been nice and friendly to him. The two chatted in the kitchen for some time, and Mary even introduced him to her newest boarder, Frank Burns. Eventually, he had become impatient and began asking when Ethel would be home. Mary, of course, was confused and told him that Ethel had moved out years before because she and Joe had gotten married. The last time Joe had been there, Ethel was temporarily staying with her mother. So Bob had, for whatever reason, gotten it in his head that Joe and Ethel had separated, which was not what happened at all. So after a few hours of being there, he said Mary had become frustrated and impatient with him and kind of bluntly told him, like, look, Ethel's not going to show up. You just need to just stop. And since it was getting late, she wanted to go to bed. Bob, of course, was undeterred. He insisted that he was going to stay until he saw Ethel. This had caused Mary to yell, quote, get out of here or I'll call the Englishman. And she was referring to Frank, who had already went into the other room to go to sleep. This threw Bob over the edge. He said he rushed at Mary and said he hit her with everything he had. He said she fell onto the floor with her legs back over her head. He then said, quote, I grabbed her by the neck. She scratched my face like nobody's business. He said he then choked her for nearly 20 minutes until he knew she was dead.
The fuck?
Then he sat back down at the kitchen table and just kept waiting for Ethel to arrive. He said, quote, she was the one I felt I must kill. I simply had to finish what I planned. While he waited, it occurred to him that Ronnie could come home before Ethel, which for him would be a serious problem. He told a reporter, quote, she was beautiful and I hated to destroy beauty.
Oh yeah, he's psycho.
So at this moment, Bob remembered something that he had read about, how a bar of soap wrapped in a towel could be an effective way of stunning Ronnie. This is known as lock socking. So he grabbed a bar of soap from the sink, wrapped it in the dish towel, and then went into the bedroom to his hiding place. A little after 3 a.m., Ronnie returned home after telling Stephen Butters goodnight. She went into the apartment and straight to her room where she began her nightly routine. You know, taking her makeup off, putting pajamas, you know, all that before she went to bed. Bob said, quote, she stayed there for the longest time. I thought she would never come out. But finally, just before 4 a.m., Ronnie entered the bedroom. And Bob swung the bar of soap as hard as he could, striking her on the head. Bob said this didn't have the slightest effect on her. Duh. Like, it's not going to feel good, but it's not going to knock her out, you fucking jackass. Like, in his mind, it was totally going to work. Totally going to work. Going to knock her unconscious. Not going to have to worry about her. No, you fucking idiot. So now with this soap crumbled on the floor, which is where the broken soap bar came from in the last episode, and Ronnie's not being knocked out, seeing his face, he grabbed her by the throat and started choking her, demanding for her to tell him where Ethel was. Ronnie explained the best that she could, you know, with his hands around her fucking throat, that her sister was at her home with her husband. This was when Bob said he lost all control. He applied pressure to her throat, strangling Ronnie. He said, quote, I wanted to let Ronnie live if I could. We were always pals. I suppose she thought I was going to rape her. She said, please don't touch me. I just had an operation. And the doctor said, if I have intercourse, I could die. Bob believed he had held on to Ronnie tightly for nearly 2 hours, but he couldn't be sure for how long he actually did.
Jesus.
Yeah. It takes less than 10 minutes to strangle somebody. Like, the fuck is wrong with you? You have lost every marble in your noggin, sir. Jesus. So, once he literally choked the life out of Ronnie, he ripped off her slip and left her on the bed. He then stuffed Mary's body under Ronnie's bed. Which, I mean, he never explained why he did that. But he did. He was just about to leave the room when he noticed the green alarm clock sitting on the dresser. He said the glowing from the clock resembled an eye that had been watching him while he committed both murders. So he grabbed it, stuffed it in his pocket, and left the room. He was on his way out of the apartment when he remembered Frank was inside and had been introduced to him. So Frank could point police in his direction. So to avoid this, he crept into Frank's room and, using the ice pick that he had intended to kill Ethel with, stabbed Frank in the head. Which, I'm sorry, my guy, this was not caused by your schizophrenia. There are plenty of people that have schizophrenia, and they do not go around killing people.
Right.
Most schizophrenics are harmless. So, no, sir. Then, he killed Frank just so Frank couldn't point the police in his direction. He was definitely of some kind of sound mind when he did this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're aware of what you're doing, okay? So Bob said, quote, I struck him the first time in the temple. So far as it would go, the poor fellow lay there twitching but did not bleed. I had hit him 11 times. So now with all three occupants of the home dead, Bob grabbed his coat and left a little after 6 a.m. He told the audience of the Tribune, quote, I'm certainly sorry I killed all three of them. There was only the one I was after, and that was Ethel. I don't know whether it was hate or love that made me want to kill her. If she had come in first, I probably would have killed her and nobody else.
Damn, he was after her.
I know. Could you imagine being her, like, knowing that you were the one that was supposed to die?
Right.
So before ending the interview, the reporter asked Bob what he expected to happen to him now that he had confessed and would most definitely be apprehended. His answer was, quote, whatever's coming to me, I'll take.
So nonchalant.
Like, yeah, you're fucking not of sound mind when you did this. No. So investigators had no idea that this interview was taking place until the evening edition of the Herald Examiner hit the papers, that it hit the stands. They had no idea. They learned with everyone else in the country that Robert Bob Irwin had confessed to the triple murder of Mary, Ronnie, and Frank.
Yeah.
Okay, so it might have been confusing a little bit on who let the interview out. So, like I said, Chicago Tribune had been the one to cut the deal with Bob. But they were not the ones that let the cat out of the bag. The Herald had found out about the deal and had scooped the story, then released the interview before the Chicago Tribune could.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so both papers were just like, no, we're going to obstruct justice and get a front page story. And the Chicago Tribune did it for nothing because they got nothing out of it. So, of course, obviously, investigators believe that Harold was the one that had done the interview. But once they reached the office of the Herald, they had learned that they hadn't done the interview. They're just the ones that released it. And that Bob was still at the Morrison Hotel with staff from the Tribune who had conducted the interview. Not sure how those at the Herald got their hands on the interview tape, but they did somehow. So on June 28th of 1937, Bob was arrested and then brought back to New York after waiving extradition and declaring his willingness to take responsibility for the murders. According to the New York Times, Bob was janty, giggling at times, and didn't have the slightest trace of remorse as he confessed over and over again to detectives who had taken him back to New York from Chicago. Like, I don't need you to tell me the story over and over and over again. Just shut the fuck up, okay? Enjoy the ride. You have a right to remain silent, okay? Do that, please. So once they arrived back in New York, Bob was taken to the police precinct and questioned until right about 3 a.m. A police spokesperson told reporters that Bob had made a confession to Detectives Owens and Crimmins on the plane from Chicago to New York at the station, and they had confirmed his statements to be true. Investigators stated Bob was cooperative from the moment they picked him up in Chicago, and he even seemed eager to get back to New York to face his punishments for what he had done. Fucking weird.
He's sick.
I know. One report stated that Bob boasted to investigators that he was willing to plead guilty to the murders and that he was not afraid of death in the electric chair. Okay, tough guy. That's what they all fucking right? say. Until they actually have to face it. So, Bob goes on to appear in front of the Court of General Sessions on July 1st. Here, his lawyer, Samuel Lebowitz, enters a plea of not guilty. And according to the New York Times, the courtroom was packed full of, quote, an admiring crowd of middle-aged women hoping to get a glimpse of Irwin. What the actual fuck is wrong with people?
Fucking crazy.
Like, what is it about murderers that bring all the crazy fucking women out? Fucking get it together, people. Ugh. Like, I get wanting to put a face with the person that did it and being interested in the case. I mean, hello. We have a podcast to talk about this shit. But to be romantically right. involved or interested in these people, I don't.
Crazy as hell.
Understand it. Like all the women that fawned over Ted Bundy.
Yep. That's what I was going to say.
Even got married while in prison. Many of them have. And it's like, what? Oh, I don't get it. You need mental fucking help, woman. Same with, Charles Manson.
Yep. They went crazy over him.
I know. What the fuck is wrong with you? You need to, like, get your brain chemistry checked or something. Okay, anyway. So once his plea was entered, Bob was removed from the courtroom and taken back to his cell in order to await trial. Bob's defense attorney stated to the press, quote, "This is the most interesting case I've ever had. Due to the social implications, you cannot tell me how many more Irwins are running around loose. I hope that society will, learning a lesson from the Irwin case, make a more logical, insane approach to the problem dealing with the criminally insane." So for the Times, it's crazy. Like, his defense attorney is saying, okay, yeah, he's wrong. He did it, but he's also insane. And hopefully society will figure out a better way to handle those that are criminally insane than how we currently are. And it's his defense attorney saying that, not the prosecutor. So it's like, okay, you're not wrong, sir. You're not wrong. So in early September, before Bob's trial was set to start, his attorney, Samuel Leibowitz, arranged for a press conference where he promised his client would be on hand for any questions the press may have. But when Bob was brought into the interview room in the courthouse, quote, his wild eyes, unshaved and unkempt, had appeared to have no idea what was going on. So he just looked fucking crazy. Once he was seated beside Leibowitz, Bob, unprompted and randomly, said, quote, for 2 weeks, they had doctors staring and leering at me. Their eyes, they bothered me. I couldn't stand it. They beat me from behind with a lock sock. Six men with lock socks. I couldn't fight. Six men with lock socks. Lock socks. Yeah, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. I don't think anybody knew what the fuck he was talking about. Just talking nonsense.
And don't like it.
Yeah, I don't know. So Bob said a little more to the reporters before he was returned to his cell. But to the reporters, it was very clear that this entire press conference was a strategy for the defense. They did it to try to move public opinion towards Bob. Like, he's clearly insane. He clearly did it, but let's put it in front of some cameras in a manic state so that way everyone can see and report on his strange behavior. That's how we're going to get him off. So it was clear that his attorney was laying the groundwork for an insanity defense. And the press said just that. His attorney had even told reporters that Bob had a dual personality. He said he had seen his client only the day before, and Bob was calm, collected, and of sound mind. And that on that day, he was acting like a raving maniac. So after several months of delays, Bob finally went to trial on March 24th, 1938. So just nearly a year to the day. Because Bob had already confessed, this trial wasn't an issue if he had committed the murders. It was about his mental condition at the time of the murders, and if he was now capable of understanding the proceedings and being able to aid in his defense. So the trial would, you know, go on as you would expect it to, with only one difference. The jury was presented with testimony taken from 20 sessions of a Lucini Commission. This is a government body that was established to oversee the care and treatment of those that are deemed mentally ill or insane, which I've never heard of that before this case. Yeah, didn't know that was a thing. So in this, the jury heard 28 eyewitness testimonies, as well as physical and documented evidence. Leibowitz presented testimony from Dr. Leland Hensey and Dr. Bernard Gluck. Both of these doctors had actually evaluated Bob themselves for a total time of nearly 70 hours spent with Bob between the two of them. So during this time, Hensey stated that Bob's behavior would at times become frightening and erratic. He said Bob would begin these interviews by excessively talking, and that he would become extremely upset if he was interrupted for a simple thing as the doctor giving the explanation for a concern that Bob himself had raised. He stated these interruptions oftentimes prompted Bob to, quote, stare at the examiner, grit his teeth, pound on the table viciously with his fist, and yell that he would not suffer any interruptions. The main subject that Bob would talk at length about was his spiritual beliefs. In The Mad Sculptor, written by Harold Schweitzer, I think is how you say it, it says about this, quote, Irwin worked himself into a pitch of near frenzied exhalation while discoursing on his current efforts to transform his body through the power of electricity. Bob told the psychiatrist, there is no limit to the extent that I can build myself mentally and physically through electricity. I can stop the action of my heartbeat, prevent my lungs from expanding and contracting, control the passage of food through my body, all of this done by electricity. No, sir, you cannot.
That's not how that works.
No. Your body naturally does that. You cannot do that. But okay, you do you, my guy. District Attorney William Dodge argued that Bob was, in fact, both sane and knew what he was doing when he committed the murders. And he knew what he was doing he knew that what he was doing was both morally and illegally wrong. He pointed to several times where it appeared as though Bob had been withholding information. Upon his arrest, Bob was reluctant to disclose information about the crimes, which implies a certain level of awareness to what he had done. And like this, when asked about the fee that he had received for his confession, Bob explained that he had planned to use a small portion of it for himself, saying, quote, "If I find myself in an institution for life or something like that, I would like to get a small amount of money so that I can hire someone of my fellow patients or prisoners, whatever you want to call them, and such an institution for $1 a week. You can get people to do many things for you."
Yeah, he's lost his shit.
Yeah. Okay, my guy. Like, if you say so. So, Dodge argued that this reluctance to give information was evidence of his guilt, saying that Bob had already contemplated his options when he was arrested, and that, quote, "Irwin contemplated the possibility of a trial, which would terminate by committing him to an institution for the insane." They argued that the facts surrounding Bob's voluntary surrender in Chicago and the bargain he struck with the paper, which he initiated, had accomplished all on his own, indicated that he was mentally sound. Which, yeah, sounds like it to me. So after weighing all the evidence presented, the jury decided that Robert Bob Irwin was in fact sane at the time of the murders. And because of this, his case went to trial on November 7th, 1938. And Samuel Lebowitz, the defense attorney, did everything he could to stall the trial. He objected to jurors, repeatedly filed motions to postpone the trial, which to an extent you get because like a case like his is difficult. Because like, you know, he's guilty, but you still have to defend him.
Right.
Then on November 15th, the press announced the surprising news that Bob had accepted a plea deal where he would plead guilty to second-degree murder for all three, and they would take the death penalty off the table. I thought you weren't afraid to die in the electric chair, my guy.
I know, that's what you said.
Yeah.
Wasn't scared.
Clearly you were. So the DA told the press that because of Bob's previous record of insanity, there was a possibility that the jury may have declared him mentally insane, which at some point he could be released from confinement. So if found insane during the trial, they would put him in an institution for the criminally insane until he was deemed, quote, unquote, cured. Then they would release him. The DA did not want to take that chance. So he offered him this plea, because in many cases where this exact thing happens, more people are killed or harmed in some way before the person responsible is actually put in prison rather than in an institution. Like, this shit still happens today. Our system really needs to be revisited. So with this plea in place, the prosecution recommended that Bob receive a sentence of 90 years to life for each count to be served consecutively instead of getting the death penalty. Okay. For anyone that does not remember, consecutively means that if you have 2-year terms in prison, you have to complete your first 10-year sentence before you can start your second year. On November 28th, Bob went before Judge James Wallace, who sentenced him to 139 years in prison.
Wow.
He got 99 years for the murder of Burns, 20 years for Veronica's murder, and another 20 for Mary's murder. When Judge Wallace asked Bob if he had anything to say on his own behalf, Bob said, quote, "Ordinarily, this business of asking a prisoner if he has anything to say is a mere formality. The man is generally guilty of willful aggression against society, or he is too ignorant to speak for himself. I am not guilty of any willful aggression against society." But he wasn't the gun there. Yeah, I know. I have no idea what the fuck he's trying to say. Like, I don't know. And he wasn't done. He had more to say. But Judge Wallace interrupted him and said, quote, "This is no time for a long speech or extended remark."
Oh.
This judge is like, "I'm not playing with you today." Yeah, this judge is like, "I'm not playing with you. get out of here. But Bob ignored the judge and continued saying, quote, "This is a farce. I have a definite and real reason why sentence should not be pronounced. You say you represent justice. I say you do not. You represent a rich man's justice."
Damn.
Bob, my guy, you killed three people. Then you made a great efforts to hide it.
Right.
My guy, this being a rich man's justice, as you call it, is not the issue here, Bob. You are the issue.
You're the issue.
Like, okay, so once they get Bob under control, Judge Wallace reread the charges and the sentence. He then turned to the DA to make it very clear that he had accepted the plea of guilty on all three charges because of the DA's recommendation, but that he did not, but he did it with reservations. Judge Wallace said, quote, "There's no question the defendant is mentally unsound. In my opinion, the state has lost nothing in accepting these pleas, except possibly the execution of this defendant, and that would bring no credit to the state." So the judge, you know, he's like, "I'm not sure if sending this man to prison is the right thing to do because of his mental state, but at least we're not executing him."
Right.
So the judge wasn't the only one who questioned the DA's decision to send Bob to prison either. A little over a week after Bob was sent to Sing Sing, he was transferred to Dannemora State Hospital for the criminally insane. After two Sing Sing psychiatrists had evaluated him and said he was definitely very much insane. Which, duh. Like, we all can tell you that.
Yeah, he's lost his shit.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he fell off his damn rocker a long time ago. So while there, he studied foreign languages and taught himself how to speak French, German, Latin, Polish, Italian, and apparently even invented his own some kind of international language. While he wasn't working on his education, he was writing letters to his former psychiatrist, Frederick Wortham, and began a long-distance correspondence with a woman in Cuba. Again, what the fuck is wrong with people?
They're off their fucking rocker.
Right, exactly. You fell off right along with him. What the fuck is wrong with you? Okay, anyway. But within a year, his anger got the best of him when he became one of the more unruly patients at the hospital and was often required to spend time in solitary confinement. In 1975, Robert Bob Irwin died at 67 years old at the Matawan State Hospital for the Criminally Insane after an 8-year battle with cancer. And that's it. That's part two. And the end of New York's Easter Sunday murders.
That was crazy.
I know, right? Like, it's sad because
I thought for sure it was the dead.
Yeah, I thought so too when I first started looking into it, but no.
I thought for sure it was the dad, especially after he went on those interviews.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote it the way that I did it. So that way it was like set up like as if he did it, but then it's like, bam, no, he didn't.
I know. I didn't see that one coming.
I told you it was going to be because you do not see it coming.
No, I thought for sure. And at one point I even thought the sister.
Oh, really?
Yes. I did. When you started talking about the diary and stuff like that, and like, even though her name didn't start with a B or whatever, like when you were talking about B and then like her sister kept coming up in her diary and stuff, I thought like maybe that was a code or something that she was scared of her sister.
Oh, I didn't think of it like that.
I was way off.
Like it's just sad. This one's very sad. Because it's very clear that he is mentally ill.
It really is.
Like, I don't know what his diagnosis would be today. Because diagnosis in the 30s, like, you can't really put a lot of stock into them.
Mm-mm.
But he definitely had something going on upstairs. I mean.
Yeah, he was not mentally all there at all.
No. Definitely not.
But and they do say love makes you do crazy things.
Yeah, but I don't obsession. Know about. Obsession. He was obsessed. I don't know.
You hear about it, though.
I don't know what I think.
Look at stalkers that kill the people they're stalking. Or how many murderers actually stalk their people before they kill them.
That's very true. I don't know. All I know is this.
It's like a cat and mouse.
Was crazy. He had something going on in his head.
Yeah, he was definitely mentally unstable.
Yeah, but definitely. I think that he was aware of what he had done. Like, he had to have been aware enough to be able to then leave the apartment, then try to flee, and then call and try to confess. I mean, he stood there with his hands around Mary's neck for 20 minutes. And according to him, possibly up to 2 hours for Ronnie's. Like, even in a manic state, he would have snapped out of it at some point.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, like, and it takes 5 minutes to strangle someone to death. He held Mary's throat for 20 minutes. At some fucking point, you're aware of what you're doing. I think, in my opinion, I don't think he ever planned to kill Ethel. I think he was mad because she didn't want him. She decided to be with Joe. And so he decided he was going to punish her for not wanting to be with him. And he was going to kill her mom and her sister in order to punish her.
That makes sense too. Yeah, I didn't look at it like that.
Yep, that's what I think. And then tell, oh, well, she was the one that I planned to kill. Because not only is she grieving the loss of her mom and her sister, but now she feels guilty for their death.
Mm-hmm. Right. That does make sense.
Yep, that's what I think it is.
Yeah, I see that. I see that too.
Because he's like, well, if I can't have you, then you get to live a life of hating yourself. Right. So I think it was all planned. I could be wrong, though. I don't really know.
Right.
Oh, but that's it. That's all I got.
That's a good theory. All righty.
I thought it was a good one to do for Easter.
It is a good one.
Okay. So that's all I got. Anything before we sign off here?
Nope.
All right. Let me see. I'm trying to think of what I got next week. Oh, next week is a good one.
Oh, God.
It's a good one.
Great.
Yep. It's so good. So you're going to be like, what the fuck? Yep. So we'll be back next week for another episode. Hope everyone had a great Easter yesterday. All that fun stuff. As always, the photos you can find on our Facebook page. The link for our Facebook page is in the description for the episode. Make sure you give us a rate and a review. Don't forget to subscribe so you get those notifications when the new episodes are released. And we hope you keep listening. And remember to
watch for monsters.
Don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.